You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. There's a bill in the state Senate that looks to stop book bans here in the Commonwealth after significant upticks in book challenges here in the state, according to the Massachusetts Library Association. Now, we've been looking at banned comics with BU Professor Joel Christian Gill, who's our guide to the world of comics. And last week, Joel introduced us to Maya Kobabe, author of the book Most Targeted for Bans in 2021 and 2022. Gender Queer is Kobabe's graphic memoir about the exploration of identity. When we talked, I started by asking Joel why he wanted to talk about this particular work.
Gender Queer is the kind of book that I think is what makes comics really special. You know, I say this a lot, like comics are empathy machines, right? Like they teach people how to understand other people, like understanding things you don't necessarily understand. So when you're writing in graphic memoir form, it's definitely a window. It's a window into seeing someone else's experience. And what Maya has done beautifully in your book is to basically explain to us what it means to be genderqueer. And I know that when he was originally doing this book, it wasn't for like the general public, it was for their family. And I think that when you see this book and you read it, you have a better understanding of what it's like to be someone like Maya, who's gone through this possibility. And I think that's what makes books like these really important and in a lot of ways beautiful toward the human experience, because they tell us what it's like to be someone else.
Was that the goal, Maya?
That was so beautifully said, Joel. Thank you. Yeah, I wrote this book in huge part because I was trying to come out to specifically my family and my friends and my sort of comics community. And I was having a really hard time figuring out how to explain gender, non-binary pronouns, what all of this meant to me in conversation. And I came to the conclusion that I was like, I have to sit down and write about this. I think that's the only way I'm really going to be able to say everything I want to say and sort of tell the whole story I want to tell. And comics seemed like the best medium for that.
So Maya, I'm going to take a second here to do two things at once. I'm going to read people just a couple of sentences from Gender Queer and use it to dive into a piece of it that was one piece of the empathy machine, to use Joel's term, for me in reading this graphic memoir. At one point you write, quote, "I wish I didn't fear that my identity is too political for a classroom. I wonder if any of these kids are trans or non-binary, but don't have words for it yet. How many of them have never seen a non-binary adult? Is my silence actually a disservice to all of them? Every time I fail to give my pronouns, I feel like a coward," end quote. And you talk a lot about your exploration of your pronouns. It is a search for you, a real search. And in the end, you settle on I am and air, which are unfamiliar to most people. They were unfamiliar to me. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, I chose a rare favorite. I use the pronouns, neo-pronoun set titled Spivak pronouns. There's a whole Wikipedia page if you want to read about them. These pronouns have been sort of independently discovered or created multiple times because it's basically just they, them, there with a TH removed, which is a concept that's not too challenging to come up with if you're looking at the English language and trying to think, how do we create a singular non-binary pronoun set? And I also really like they, them, but when I switched to non-binary pronouns was back in like late 2015, early 2016, when the conversation around pronouns was pretty different. And there were still a lot of arguments online about whether they, them was grammatically correct for a singular person. And now many dictionaries have weighed in and said, yes, yes, they are. But I came across the Spivak pronouns. I usually pronounce them E-M-air, but some people also pronounce them A-M-air. And I just fell in love with them. They're challenging, they're weird, they're hard to use, but they're thought-provoking. They demand questions. They start conversations. And that's kind of what I wanted them to do. I wanted them to be almost like an intro into a conversation about language and about gender and about how what words we use affect how we think about things.
So it's interesting, Joel Christian Gill, you know, demand questions, start conversations. Maya is talking about words doing that. We are, with you, having an ongoing conversation on Radio Boston about the really profound way that images do that, too.
Yeah, and I think this builds into the same kind of conversation, right? The idea of looking at an image, and I've talked about this before, but it bears repeating, that we all have this shared visual language. No matter who we are, there's a shared visual language that if we all sat down and told everybody to draw a house, they'd draw the same house. And so taking that and using that as the basis for the conversation means that we pour ourselves into those things, right? Like, you know, in 2015, the word of the year was the LOL emoji, but it wasn't a brown or a white emoji. It was a yellow emoji because no one ever asked to change that yellow emoji to a colored face because we see ourselves in this abstract image. And that's what comics do. Because of the simplicity of the form, we see ourselves in these images. And that's why it builds the empathy, because we can actually see ourselves in those things. And I've said this before and I'll say it again. And we know that they build empathy because people keep banning them. And the people who don't like us to build empathy for other groups are the ones who see that empathy working and going, can't have that happen.
So I want to stay there. Let's do the banned part now. And I want to dive into it in a number of ways. Maya Genderqueer comes out in 2019, gets challenged in 2021, now banned in at least 49 school districts around the country. Is that painful for you? It's got to be personal for you. Did you expect it? Are you surprised? And if you're surprised, are you surprised that it didn't happen sooner?
It's been a very strange experience. I am certainly not naive. I'm very aware that queer and trans narratives are frequently, you know, challenged or debated in public. And so I did brace myself a little bit when the book came out, wondering, you know, will there be some negative backlash? Will I be getting some online hate? But for the first 2 years, it was almost entirely positive and very joyful receptions for this book. As you said, it came out in mid-2019. It was widely purchased and celebrated by librarians. I had so many librarians come up to me at book signings and say things like, I know exactly what reader I'm going to give this to. And because so many librarians purchased it, it meant that it was in many, many libraries. It also won 2 awards from the American Library Association, a Stonewall Honor and an Alex Award. And that also meant that many libraries purchase all the ALA award winners. So I think it wasn't challenged for about 2 years because it kind of needed that much time to build up momentum of it being sort of known outside of queer circles and comics circles. And I also think the fact that it's an award winner actually meant that it was more available to be challenged. If you look over the list of recently challenged and banned books, a lot of them are Alex Award winners. And I also think the book has been challenged because it is a comic. And as Joel said, there's a real power in images. And there's something more visceral, I think, about seeing something as an image than necessarily reading about it in as a paragraph of written text. And it definitely has been stressful, but I don't take the challenges as a valid statement about the quality of my work, other than that it brings reactions. I would say the area in which I find it most upsetting is just what these book challenges say about sort of the state of where we're at in this country.
I want to stay in an uncomfortable space in this, the challenging of the book, the challenging of the images, the challenging of the content. Joel, I'll come to you first. I've given a lot of thought to how to talk about this part. I'll come to you first, and then Maya, I'll come back to you. I'd done a bunch of reading about genderqueer and people's hypotheses about why it's been challenged before I then read genderqueer. And there's a particular page of a sexual experience in the graphic memoir that often gets referred to, sort of people hypothesizing this is sort of the tipping point for its banning. And so, Joel, when we studied sort of Mouse together here on the show as a banned comic, we talked about the single page with the hanging and how you come to that page and it's so there and so in your face and so graphic, it demands empathy from the viewer. And as I went through genderqueer, I was expecting that page. And for me, I never found one quite like that. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean, instead, this was an unfolding of somebody's life experience. And that was striking to me, Joel, since so much had been made about one specific page. And I've been anxious to bring that to you sort of as your student, Joel, and say, this was the experience I had.
You know, the interesting thing about that, Tiziana, and I think this is the issue with people who ban books anyway. They didn't need that page. They were going to ban this book, whether that page was in there or not. If Maya decided with their publisher to take that page out, that book would still be banned, right? Because it's not really about that page. The page just becomes a justification. They need something to hang it on, right? So they can say, see, this is the thing. This is the thing that we're pointing at that says that this is a book that shouldn't be made. And they're looking for justifications because in reality, there is no justification. The fact that we demonize and politicize people in this country, whether they are queer people, Black and brown people, immigrants, there always has to be an other that we can point to say it our problems. And when you add politics to that, and when politicians run out of ideas, they always got to point to somebody who's at fault. And we've seen this throughout the 20th century. And this is just the newest iteration of that. I mean, it's actually not even a new iteration. It's just like a rehash of the same idea. Like the thing about these ideas about conserve the status quo of like the place that we used to be, or the place where this, you know, this perceived idea that it used to be better in other places, is to assume that queer people never existed in history. And queer people have always existed in history. It's to assume that people have never had sex. People have always had sex. When you talk about these things and you accurately educate teenagers, young people about these things, they actually are better people because of it. And I think there never needed to be a singular page in genderqueer for people to want to ban it. It was just the idea of making someone who is, you know, not the norm in this country, not the majority in this country, the exotic other that we can point to and say, see, they're coming after our children, or see, they're taking our jobs, or see, their music is infiltrating everything. This is just another one of those things. And I don't think it needed that page.
So Maya, with that running fresh in my head, the piece that I wanted to bring to you about that page in that section was, I also found myself thinking there were so many texts that for my kids when they were growing up, I have young adult children now, both, you know, 18 and 21, where I thought, if my kid's going to encounter that book, and I'll use for an example, the first Hunger Games book, which one of my kids wanted to read in fourth grade. And I remember thinking, if my child's going to encounter that content, I want to know, because there's a conversation I want to have with my child when my child's encountering that content. And I thought about that with genderqueer. I would, you know, if my kids were reading this book in middle school, I would want to be, know, and have a conversation with my kid along the way. And where does that fit into conversations about school libraries and access, et cetera? And you, who is so deeply engaged in educating people, how do you think about that?
I definitely agree that it's good for parents and kids to read kind of more challenging texts together. I also think that encountering a slightly harder topic, whether that's a historical atrocity like the Holocaust, or whether that is topics of sexuality or a story about abuse or something, I think that encountering those in a book is just about the safest way that you can first encounter that material, because you can really ingest it at your own speed. Unlike in a movie, for example, that sort of plays at a fixed rate, with a book, you can pause. Like if a page makes you uncomfortable, you can close it for a while, you can set it down, you can think about it, you can flip back to it later with context of another, like, later part of the story. I really think books are perhaps the best way to learn about these things. And as Joel said, I think it's really important to learn about, you know, all of the parts of the human experience, even ones that you might not have yourself, and ones that you will have yourself, or you may encounter, or a friend of yours may encounter sometime in their life. And it's interesting you say you can't even point to a specific page. I'm like pretty sure I know what page you've been referring to, but I'm not even 100% sure myself, because there are some instances, like there are, I think, two pages with like full nudity in my book, but they're both scenes in doctor's office around a pap smear exam. And neither of those pages that have full nudity are the ones that tend to get complained about, even though they are theoretically a bit more, maybe even like explicit, or they show more than other pages that can be complained about. So I think the page that you're talking about, but let me know if I'm wrong, is one where there is a scene of two queer adults. That page is about consent. The character asks the other character, like says, I am uncomfortable with what we're doing, or it's not giving me the experience I wanted. Can we stop what we're doing and do something else? And the other partner says, yes, of course. And it's really troubling to me that this page gets called out as like so, you know, inappropriate for young people when this is a scene trying to demonstrate that even in the middle of a sexual encounter, you should be able to communicate with your partner and say, you know, hey, this isn't working for me, or I need a pause, or I need to stop. And that it is okay, like mid-act, to sort of shift your consent. Yeah. And I think that is something deeply important for teenagers to learn and read about. And it's really frustrating to me that that is like the thing they're saying is like not okay, when I'm like, no, teenagers need to know about consent.
So I'll stay with you, Maya Kobabe, and we're speaking with Maya Kobabe, author of Gender Queer, a Graphic Memoir, and Joel Christian Gill of Boston University, our guide through the world of comics here. I'll stay with you. You know, Joel talks about comics being empathy engines. And there were so many times in this graphic memoir that even though you were talking about experiences I'd never had, they resonated with me so many times in experiences I did, right? Just empathy, 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 empathy so many times. And towards the end, I found myself thinking, are you ever exhausted with being out there? I mean, this this graphic memoir is out there now. And because it's banned in 49 school districts and it's become controversial, you don't ever get to turn it off. And I mean, what you just described is something that happened in your life. And it's an important example for teenagers, but it's also a deeply, deeply intimate moment in your life. And is it ever too much for you? And are you ever exhausted?
I definitely get exhausted by life, for sure. However, I stepped into the writing of this book, I think, with a lot of a clear knowledge of what it could potentially bring. I have a lot of privilege and a lot of safety. I live in the liberal Bay Area. I am white. I'm middle class. I have supportive parents. I have a job that I work from home and I knew wouldn't be threatened by coming out. I knew that coming out, and also that like being a public queer non-binary figure, wouldn't threaten my healthcare, my housing, my job, my safety, my relationships. And it was partly that amount of like privilege and safety that made me want to write this book. Also thinking, you know, I can write this book with probably, at the time I thought, very few negative consequences. And if the writing of it makes sort of that path, that coming out path, easier for other people, that feels like a worthwhile thing to do. Both my parents are educators. I also knew that like setting yourself up to talk about a topic and sort of presenting yourself as something of an expert means that people will ask you questions about it, and you will be the recipient of many questions, some of which might be fairly uninformed. And I don't think that any person of any marginalized identity is required to be an educator about their identity to the majority, but it is a position you can volunteer for. And I kind of volunteered for it knowingly, because I felt like I think I do have the energy to be an educator about this, again, because of the amount of like privilege and safety I carry in so many other realms of my life. So I'm tired of the book bans, but I am not tired of talking about queerness and about queer comics, which are in fact two of my favorite topics to talk about.
I think Genderqueer in a lot of ways provides a service to straight people, which I think was the intent of the book in the first place, to see what it's like to answer a lot of those questions, like all these different things, like, you know, from, you know, how long, when did you know? How long did you know? What was it like going through it? How did you feel about that? And also, like, if you're a parent, let's just imagine that today you're in your 30s or 40s and you find out your 12-year-old is genderqueer. You may not know anything about this. You haven't been exposed to this throughout your entire life. So it was like a great experience to like give that to a child and have them learn this and read it with them and ask questions. And I think that point that you said, Tiziana, about reading a book, reading The Hunger Games with your kid, is an important thing that I don't think we spend a lot of time thinking about. That's hard work. And for the vast majority of people, we don't want to do the hard work. The vast majority of society does not want to do the hard work. We don't want to answer the hard questions. We want to give them like, watch this video or do it at school, or don't learn about it at all because we don't want to talk about it because it makes us uncomfortable. And being a parent means learning about what's happening in the world and giving it to your kids. And I think there are large groups of people who just don't want to learn it for whatever reason, whether it's cultural, whether it's religious based, or whether it's just, you know, like they just don't think it's right for whatever reason. They don't want to take that time. And I think a book like Genderqueer fits squarely in the pantheon of books that teach us about humanity.
That was Joel Christian Gill, inaugural chair of BU's MFA program and visual narrative, and Maya Kobabe, author of the graphic memoir Genderqueer, talking with us in Studio 2 last week.